What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Now let's kick this thing off.
Bill Pulte is the CEO of Pulte Capital. He's also the inventor of Twitter Philanthropy, a global movement to help our fellow humans. In this conversation, we discuss everything from Bitcoin to rising home prices to building wealth. I really hope you enjoy this one. Bill's awesome, and this one was a ton of fun. Before we get into this episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. First up is Matrixport. Have you lost your way in this low-yield environment while searching for a better store of value to beat inflation? Look no further. Invest with Matrixport to get more out of your crypto. You can invest today and earn up to 30% annualized yields. Matrixport is Asia's fastest growing digital asset platform founded by two crypto veterans. With $10 billion in assets under management and custody, Matrixport offers one-stop crypto financial solutions, including fixed income, DeFi in one click, structured products, Cactus custody, spot OTC, and lending. You can earn from high single digit with fixed income to high double digit yield with their dual currency product. If you hold crypto and you're looking for a yield, this app you don't want to miss. Go download the Matrixport app and enjoy a welcome offer of high yield on USDC for new users. Remember, I just did a podcast with Jihan Wu, one of the founders, and a lot of folks said they enjoyed it. So you can go listen to that and learn more about Matrixport as well. Go check them out by downloading the Matrixport app or go to matrixport.com. Next up is Gemini. Gemini is a leading regulated cryptocurrency exchange, a wallet, and a custodian that makes it simple and secure to buy, sell, store, and earn Bitcoin, Ether, and over 40 other cryptocurrencies. They offer industry-leading security, insurance, and uptime. Gemini is the go-to trusted platform for beginner and sophisticated investors alike. You can open a free account in under 3 minutes at gemini.com/pomp and get $20 of Bitcoin after you trade $100 or more within 30 days. Head on over to gemini.com/pomp and you'll get that $20 of Bitcoin for free after you trade $100 or more within 30 days. Gemini, a leading regulated cryptocurrency exchange, wallet, and custodian. I'm a big fan, and I think you will be too once you head over and check them out at gemini.com/pomp. Last but not least is Cosmos. Cosmos is building the internet of blockchains, marking a new era of interoperability, scalability, and usability. The free flow of assets and data between blockchains and bridges to Ethereum and Bitcoin will unleash the potential of DeFi, NFTs, and much, much more. You can dive into Cosmos at cosmos.network/pomp. Again, cosmos.network/pomp, or go click on the link in the description. Cosmos, the internet of blockchains, marking a new era of interoperability, scalability, and usability. All right, let's get in this episode with Bill. I hope you guys enjoyed this one.
Anthony Pompliano runs Pomp Investments. All views of him and the guests on his podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Pomp Investments. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp or his guests as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his personal opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
Bill Pulte is here. July was the fourth consecutive month of record price appreciation, and it marked the highest annual rate of price growth since the index began in 1987. Absolutely nuts. The median existing home sales price in August of this year rose 14.9% from a year earlier to $356,700. That's right. There's a 15% increase in the median existing home sales price in America. Households that bought homes in May are spending almost 21% of their income on monthly mortgage payments, which is above the average rate for the past decade. And so, Bill, help us understand why exactly home prices are exploding like this. Like, it's actually a pretty complex situation in terms of why they're going up so much. But what's kind of your read on this?
Well, I think you have to get back to basics, right? So supply and demand. Everybody knows about supply and demand. Let's look at demand for a second. You have a situation where COVID happened and literally the federal government came in and started buying mortgage-backed securities. If the federal government hadn't bought the mortgage-backed securities, you'd have a real problem because liquidity would dry up in the mortgage bond market. And the mortgage bond market is actually what creates a lot of liquidity in the mortgage industry. So you have this incredible fuel for demand, which is you have the federal government buying mortgage-backed securities. You have low interest rates, which were reduced even further in COVID. So on the demand side of things, you just have gasoline on the fire. And then on the supply side, you have the situation where COVID created, I would argue, potentially the biggest supply issue that the industry's ever seen in the form of, you know, starting, stopping. You have the lumber prices going up and all this stuff. So if you look at the demand and you look at the supply, it's just creating an environment pump where, you know, the prices just have gotten to unbelievable levels. Now, the interesting thing will be what happens in, you know, as we get into 2022, halfway through, toward the end of toward the end of 2022, will some capacity come back online so you're able to get that supply up? If you can get the supply back up, what can happen is you can start to see some moderating in the prices. But for now, those two things affecting the supply and demand, as I described, are just creating an environment where, you know, good luck keeping it. It's like keeping a beach ball underwater.
You know? Help us understand like the supply chain disruptions, right? In terms of, I think most people are like, oh, I know that there's low interest rates. I kind of sort of know that people are looking for homes. So the demand side, they can wrap their head around. But the supply chain, they don't see that every day, right? So like, what do you understand is going on?
Well, it's in part caused by the demand side. So I don't want to say, oh, it's just all supply. It's also the fact, as I said, that the federal government, and most people don't talk about this. I think it will actually happen in future elections, but people don't talk about it right now. The federal government has essentially gone in and bought large portions of the mortgage bond market. That's a huge issue. So I don't want to dismiss that. In terms of supply issues, you know, when COVID happened, I think that naturally all the manufacturers, and you see this across every industry, right? You guys see it too, and I'm sure everybody sees it with food and whatnot. But everybody, you know, forecasted, okay, we're gonna wind down, we're gonna you know, tighten up our balance sheet, we're going to you know, slow things down. And then all of a sudden, you started to see the federal government come in the mortgage bond market. You started to see liquidity stay there. I mean, there was a period of time where they didn't know what was going to happen with the mortgage bond market. And so, you know, naturally, these home builders were saying, well, you know, I don't know if we should really be building this much. So then they had to all of a sudden restart the race, right? And this time you're restarting the race with lower interest rates. You had the federal government buying the mortgage-backed securities. And so it's just been a natural game of catch-up. And that's what it's been. I mean, it's been unbelievable. I think it's been the biggest supply shock that the industry's ever seen. And I know we're seeing that in other industries as well.
Yeah. What feels even worse is like when you get the home prices going up, some of that naturally was just going to happen by people wanting to move out of cities, move into suburban areas. You get the imbalance of supply demand. So forget all the monetary and fiscal policy stuff. Like there already was going to be higher price points just because of this. When you layer in the monetary and fiscal policy stuff, then all of a sudden it just explodes. I mean, 20% correct increase, right, in terms of home prices from July of last year to this year. Sure, you can say there's a base effect in terms of prices went down during the summer last year, whatever you want to say.
No, you take the liquidity out of the mortgage market, you'll see those prices go down rapidly.
Yeah. Why do you think the government buying the mortgage-backed securities is so concerning?
Because, I do think it is, but I'm not saying so much concerning as much as it's a reality now. I mean, the mortgage industry, you know, has had third-party providers who provided liquidity, almost like a market maker type situation. But when the federal government, it's much like you know, with interest rates and the government backstopping buying the government, when the government buys treasury bonds, right? It just creates this confidence that people have to keep the liquidity going. And so if you feel that the government's always going to bail you out in the instance of mortgages, right? Are you going to be concerned about risk as much as you would if there wasn't the government there, right?
Yeah.
So if you take if you take the risk off the table, you know, then you're looking back at you know, some pretty risky things that can happen.
One of the things I want to talk about, Bill, is when you think about your career in building, there's a lot of young people who watch this. What are some of the things that you learned early on that you're like, wow, if I had known that even earlier, or things that maybe you know now that you're like, if I had learned that stuff earlier in my career, I could have leveraged that. Whether it was if you had been inside of a corporation, building your own business, or just kind of doing transactions, et cetera. Like, what are some of those lessons learned?
You know, I've been reflecting on that a lot lately because one of the things I've been doing is funding a lot of businesses with entrepreneurs, kind of like what you do. And, you know, it sounds crazy, but I would just say, you know, do the work. You know, so many people try to look for the shortcut or the quick work or whatever. I give you an example. I just invested in an air conditioning business. And the guy who runs it, he's below 30. I don't want to say exactly who he is. And he keeps looking and he's watching all these different podcasts and everything. And his real talent is selling air conditioning. And I just said to him, I said, stop watching all these podcasts, stop reading all these books, just go sell the units door to door. And, you know, he doesn't want to hear that. But so I would just say, do the work, you know, watch the Pomp Show, learn what you can here, learn what you can other places, but you just got to do the work. And I think that with this liquidity that's in the market right now, if you do the work, there are so many options to get paid for it right now. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, can you believe that they're selling us, they're allowing us to buy Bitcoin at these prices right now? So, you know, go sell some air conditioning units or go sell, you know, whatever, right? And, you know, stack sats.
How important do you think it is for young people to learn, like what I'd call like the basics of business? So accounting, selling, kind of strategy, operations, like those key components versus, hey, I already know that I have an inclination to be good at sales.
Or yeah,
I already
know. I mean, if you're good at it, you should lean into it, I think, and hire the best people around you, right? At least that's how I've done it. And everybody I know who's been successful, right? I mean, even you've hired people who, you know, round out your skill set. So yeah.
Just kind of lean into exactly what
What you do. Don't run away from it. People try to do it. Now, I do think that there are some basic things, right, that you can learn. For example, I think one of the things that, good entrepreneurs, good young people can learn is finance, because finance to me is the language of business. And so, a lot of people give a lot of different advice. You know, I'm trying to avoid giving advice and just saying, hey, do the work. And if you are going to learn, you know, some type of skill set to augment it, finance, because so often I run into these businesses, I'm sure you do too. I think sometimes you're investing with people maybe who have more finance background. A lot of the people I'm dealing with don't have a finance background, and they don't really know how much money they're taking home at the end of the day. And the inability to know how much money you're netting after you pay the government, a lot of people don't realize they have a business partner. And even if they don't have a business partner, and that is the federal government, because they have to pay 40% of their taxes. And so I think really understanding finance can really help you become a wealthy, wealthy individual. Because if you know your core skill set, you hit it home, you hire around it, and then you really understand finance to know how much you're netting and putting in the bank. You know, one day you'll wake up and you'll be wealthy. And you got to have $10 before you have $100. You got to have $100 before you have $1,000, right? So you got to have $1 million before you have 10 million. And that was my experience too.
It feels like there's a key component to the way you talk about it. Like I talk to founders all the time and they'll always say, hey, you know, I make $10 million in my business. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about top line revenue.
Correct.
Right. And then you say, okay, well, what do you do after expenses? And then they'll give you a number.
Exactly.
And then you're like, okay, now what after that? Like you gotta like literally walk through it. And exactly. I think that's your point is that 10 million actually end up maybe being 2 million.
Yeah.
Right.
I say revenue is vanity and profitability is sanity.
I like
and,
that.
My grandfather taught it to me. And, yeah, it was just a great one because everybody, they go around to these industry trade shows, at least in our industry, beat their chest. Oh, look at how big my revenue is. And then, you know, it's like, okay, dude, but show me your bank account. How much did you take home at the end of the day? You know,
so. I know John likes that.
Yeah, so. I do. I also think it's besides just business, it's personal finance as well. Right. So
that's what I mean by
that. Yeah. 33% of millionaires never made over 100K. Which I think is an unreal stat. Just speaking, it speaks to money management and the ability to turn that $10 into $100 and $100 into $1,000.
And when we use finance, we use all these words, all these labels. Finance is just a fancy way, in my opinion, for saying math, right? And so understand the math of how you keep score in your business. I mean, that's really what you're doing, right? I mean, it's like playing in a football game and not having an accurate scoreboard. I mean, you got to have an accurate scoreboard. Otherwise, you know, what are you playing the game for?
Here's a wild stat for you that I was talking to our father over the weekend, and he said this to me, and I literally was like, I don't believe you. And so, of course, he, as soon as we got off the phone, sent me like 17,000 links to like prove to me that that it was right. But
can you guys do a show with your parents sometime?
My dad would love it.
we will discuss and negotiate with him. Study that he
can
sent
I be their agent?
No, because all we'll offer is, hey, listen, we'll come see you guys if you don't.
We,
do the
we
show.
Just heard about the math, and you got to get the finances right. We don't want you negotiating for them.
So this study shows that they surveyed 10,000 millionaires. It's the Ramsey Solutions conducted the largest survey of millionaires ever, 10,000 participants, and the top five careers of people who become a millionaire. They have engineers, they have accountants, they have management, and they have attorneys. Those are four of the five. What do you think the fifth one is? So engineer, accountant, management, attorney. The fifth one is one you would not expect. That is the highest career or the highest concentration of millionaires in a single occupation.
Salespeople?
No.
Agriculture?
No.
Lawyers, doctors?
So attorneys are in attorneys, there, but yeah. Teachers. Engineers, accountants, management, attorney, and teachers. And he was telling me, he was like, yeah, one of the top five professions for people to become a millionaire is a teacher. And I think most people are conditioned-
on a percentage basis, yeah.
Well, most people are conditioned to think, hey, teachers don't get paid a lot of money. They get paid $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, depending on if it's public or private.
But they know math.
Where they are. Well, even better than that is they're super disciplined.
Yeah.
The person that ends up becoming a teacher from like a psychological standpoint, they're not trying to go buy a yacht, right? They're not trying to go buy the Ferrari. They usually end up being somebody who, hey, I want to go to work. I want to teach people. They live within their means. They have kind of financial discipline and they'll become a millionaire. And so it makes sense. You know, you think engineers and management or attorneys, they make a lot of money. They have kind of high top line income. And so, okay, they become a millionaire. But when you look at accountants, you're like, okay, they understand accounting. Like they'll figure it out. But teachers, I think, is like really interesting because it completely dispels one of the things that most people think is true is like, oh, you have to make a ton of money. Like most teachers really don't make that much money, right? But it is one of the top five careers for millionaires.
That makes me feel good hearing that.
Why?
That teachers are doing well financially. Because yeah. It's always been the narrative.
Someone just said in the comments that, really make that it's cheating because they can get summer jobs. Like, no, that's not how this works. Yeah.
They have two jobs. Yeah.
That's an all-time comment.
So I just quickly searched the average salary of a teacher, and salary.com has it between $40,000 and $70,000. ZipRecruiter has it between $16,000 and $40,000. And then Glassdoor has it between $30,000 and $60,000. So let's call it somewhere between, you know, $20,000 to maybe $60,000 or $70,000. To be a public school teacher. And we know that 33% of millionaires, like John said, have never made more than 100K in a single year. And one of the top five professions to become a millionaire is a teacher. So it's pretty damn cool when you start to understand.
So what's the thought process behind that? You can either make a lot of money or you can be really disciplined and save a lot of money.
Well, the holy grail is you do both, right? Yeah. Is you have incredible earning potential, you make a ton of money, and then on top of that, you're financially disciplined. And so you actually end up getting there faster, you end up compounding it and whatever. But even if you don't make a lot, like, again, think about it. If you start working at the age of 22, right, and you get paid $50,000 a year, I'm not a mathematician, but you only need to work 20 years and now you've been paid $1 million of top line income. Now you've got expenses, you got to pay taxes, you got to do all this stuff. So,
but you can also invest.
You can invest, you can do all this stuff, right? But like you've already been paid $1 million by the time you're 42 years old and you're only making $50,000 a year and you're a teacher. So what happens if you become financially disciplined and let's say that you can save a big portion of that? Well, okay, now you've been working for 30 years, then 40 years, right? Like at some point, by the time you hit retirement, if you've been paid $50,000 a year, you literally made $2 million in top line revenue. It's to kind of Bill's point, it's not how much you made, it's how much did you keep.
Yeah.
Right? And so if you just put, let's say double that, right now it's not 50, it's 100. Well, in 10 years, you've literally made $1 million in top line revenue.
Yeah, and this applies, some people in the comments are giving us a hard time because it's like we're saying teachers are millionaires and the point is really-
Yeah, they are. No, they literally are. It's one of the top five
professions.
Well,
that's what the stat says. Yeah,
the survey. Like, I didn't make it up. Like literally teachers are millionaires. Like it is one of the top five professions to become a millionaire in the United States.
But it could be applied to anyone at that income level is my point.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying that they're getting paid $1 million a year and that's how they become a millionaire. I'm saying that they likely have a propensity for living within their means more so than anybody else. Like we all went to school. I don't remember a teacher showing up in a Corvette, right? Like I don't remember them spending like lavishly. Frankly, most of them kind of showed up to school and they probably were wearing the same clothes that they'd worn for a while. And like, it was just like, that's just what they do. They go to school, they teach, you know, during the school year and then they leave.
Well, to the point about the math, you know, they have to count what resources they have because there's little of it, right? So they have to count in order to feed themselves. Where I think people get into trouble is, especially in business, and you start selling products, for example, and to your point, you can look at the revenue line item and you can say, oh my God, look at how much money I'm making. And that revenue can be very deceiving, right? So it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the key things that you did in your life from like a finance standpoint in terms of not, maybe not understanding what to do, but like good habits that you have that you're like, okay, if doesn't matter if you make a gazillion dollars a year or you make $1 a year, if you have these types of habits, like I think that really puts you on the right path.
I would say, you know, how I made my first, let's say $1 million or $2 million, which was really, really important to me because that really gave me the confidence to go forward, was that I bought businesses or I bought into things that had cash flows. And what I mean by that is I bought positive cash flowing things. A lot of people like to buy negative cash flow. And I know you like to start, you know, small and incubate and lose money.
But, that's true.
You know, is if you focus on positive cash flow entities, you can make your life a lot easier, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you get compounding working for you. You get the it's almost like a law of nature compounding. It can work for you or against you. And so I would just say, you know, be a little bit patient. Now, it took me several years to make that first million or two. But then once I figured that out and I got the law of compounding working for me, it just went like straight up like a hockey stick. So, you know, again, this is unsexy advice, right? But, you know,
but it works.
Yeah, it works. Buy cash, buy positive cash flowing things. Could be anything. Could be an apartment. Could be a REIT. Could be a business. Could be whatever. And just let it sit there in cash day after day after day. Because if you look at the bank account day after day after day, you'll say, wow, I'm not making that much money. But then when you start looking at it, you know, after 30 days, 60 days, 120 days, right, this stuff starts to pile up. And over a period of years, you know, you'll wake up in 3 or 5 years and you'll be worth a shitload of money. And then, sorry, I don't know if I can swear on this.
You can say whatever you want.
And then
it's the internet.
Yeah, I know. But like Jimmy's channel, you can't say anything bad on it because I don't know. But I forget what I was saying. But so anyway, so if you just compound it over time, you know, I think that if I had to start all over again, that's what I'd do.
Yeah. So. One of the things that we talk about a lot is how this weekend somebody can go out and they make $1,000. Right. Yeah. So just like all these ideas. And one time Joe,
which is crazy because I think when we graduated from college, I don't know. I mean,
$1,000 was a lot.
It was right. So yeah. I mean, $1,000 is still a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
I say $1 is a lot, but yeah.
It's a lot, but, yeah. But the amount of purchasing power for $1,000 today, even versus, you know, 2005, 2010, like anywhere in that time frame, you know, look at the inflation level, right? We've literally just in the last year, 38% of all dollars, right, in the last 18 months have been printed. Inflation, the official numbers are up over 5%. So, I mean, it's pretty crazy how much purchasing power has been lost. But one of the things that we talked about was Joe was basically like, hey, if I wanted to make $1,000, what I would do is I'd actually go to a local country club and I would caddy. Basically, I'd go surround myself with rich people, right? And in some weird way, like some money would fall out of their pockets into mine, right?
Yeah, I think too, like the difference too is like, are you looking to build something sustainable that can grow and scale and make more money and become something with enterprise value or whatever, right? Like that's one scenario. But if you tell me you have until the end of the weekend to make $1,000, like what's the most high upside thing I can think of that's probably manual labor that you actually have to go outside and go do something for? It's probably the country club, right? You go to a golf course and you caddy for some people and you try to find your way to get some cash. Other than that, it's going to be hard to start something within 24, 48 hours online and build something. And make
yeah, but even then, like, let's say you put away the $1,000. Let's say you put it in Bitcoin or something else. Over time, that will compound to be significant. And, you know, I think a lot of people could look at you, Pomp, and think, oh, wow, you know, Pomp's so successful and, you know, he's investing in all these businesses and everything. But you're kind of an outlier in a sense that, you know, you have access to deals that very few people have and whatnot. So somebody might be watching this and they might not have the access to the VC channels, for example, that you have. Excuse me. And so
it's a horrible idea to angel invest if you're basically sitting pretty much anywhere in the world other than you don't have to physically be in these geographies anymore, but you have to be in the networks. And if, you know, I just go out on the street and I just ask people like, hey, anyone starting a business I want to invest, I'm going to lose money for sure.
Exactly.
Right. Because it's just
but let's do that reverse. So let's say you go out to the street and you say, hey, put your $1,000 in this REIT. I don't know, making up some, you know, some REIT. I mean, yeah, they could depreciate it, but are they going to lose money doing that?
Probably not.
Right.
Yeah. So. Well, the REITs, and then also you could even do it for not all businesses, but a lot of businesses.
No, the S&P 500, you know.
Oh yeah. Well, you can even
go and buy
you can
the
even,
SPY, you know, go you, buy the Qs.
You can even go and invest in local businesses, right? We had somebody come on, Cody Sanchez, who basically talked all about like one of the businesses that she bought into was she went to somebody, they owned a like a mailbox business, which was kind of like if you ever go to the post office and they have like PO boxes. similar type of business, but it was the local mom and pop one. Mm-hmm. And she went to them and said, hey, I love your business. I think that maybe you need help, you know, either marketing or kind of getting the word out, but I'd like to buy into the business. And so she gave them, you know, not a small amount of money, but also not millions of dollars. I don't know, what was $50,000, $100,000, whatever it was. And she bought, like, I think it was maybe a third of the business. Hmm. And the business was doing, you know, $250,000 in cash flow.
Yeah.
Right. And she's like, wait a minute, I just bought, like, this is like a no-brainer type deal.
Yeah.
And so you don't necessarily have to go and invest in the next Facebook to be able to make money. Right. It's the reason why there is so much asymmetry in early stage technology is because there's so much risk. Mm-hmm. Right. Like you basically are getting paid for the risk that you're taking. I think people forget that point about it. Right. Is they always want to say, oh, I can make a bunch of money. Everyone always looks at the upside, but the downside is zero versus a REIT or something like that. That, you know, again, sure, on a very, very outlier case that could happen, but the S&P 500 is not going to zero.
Exactly.
Right. And so the risk is very different. So you should expect that you can get a 30% return in the S&P 500 and have, you know, what's the downside? Maybe it goes down 30% and the government steps in and you know, pumps liquidity into the market like it did in May of last year or March last year. Okay. Like that's a pretty good trade-off.
Exactly.
And then if you look over a long period of time, like the stock market is not allowed to go down. Right. Exactly. You know, like it has to
not,
keep going
it's
up.
Not that instant gratification. You can't look at it every day and say, oh, wow, look at how much money I made or whatever. I mean, maybe buy something with more volatility like Bitcoin, but the SPY over time, you know,
you make money.
The damn thing just keeps going.
It's the classic saying, time in the market, not timing the market. Compounding. If you don't know anything about investing, compounding is the greatest thing in the world.
Yo, John has got some fire one-liners today. What'd you say earlier?
Many hands make light work.
Yeah.
Which is very true.
When I was like 21, I asked Mitt Romney, it was kind of weird, and I don't know him well at all, but I asked him, I said, you know, what's the key to your success at Bain Capital? And he said, my key is I buy something for the right price and I have a spinning ball effect. And to me, the spinning ball was always that compound interest. So at Bain, I guess, you know, this is what he was arguing to me. And it just always stuck with me since I was like 21, right? And so, I don't know, I just try to like literally, other than give away my money on Twitter, which frankly, I like to use the compounding to fund what I'm doing on Twitter. But, you know, that's what I try to do every day. You know, buy stuff that's low, that's spitting out cash, and then just have that spinning ball effect.
We all like Bitcoin, right? I think you like Bitcoin. I don't care what you invest in. Like it almost doesn't matter what you invest in, right? As long as you get invested because you get started, you have kind of skin in the game, you'll start paying attention, you'll start learning and all this type of stuff. But one of the things that we ran into over and over and over again was lots of people said, hey, I want to invest, but my biggest cost outside of rent and food, credit card debt. Or student loan debt, et cetera. So they have these products that allow you to refinance that stuff, lower rates. Like there's a huge advantage of doing that. And then the other piece that people forget is budgeting and saving. And so they have a whole like budgeting saving tools kit that essentially shows you, it's kind of what you were talking about earlier, like how much money do you take home? Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know that, but also how much money are you making? Like one of the things we talk about a lot is, I always laugh. I see like these like kind of personal finance folks sort of like, you know, Bill, you should try to spend $200 less a month. And somebody's like, dude, I spent $1,000 a month, right? I'm a young kid. Like, where do you want me to carve out $200 of my $1,000 of expenses? What they're probably better off doing is go figure out how to make $500 extra a month, right? So the kind of a mindset of abundance rather than, hey, how do I not make more money? And it always shocks me how many people are like, oh, I'm not going to buy Starbucks today. Like, I'm going to save the $5. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if that's necessarily going to make you rich, but like, I like the mentality, but the actual actionable thing for people, if you don't make
a ton
of money, yeah, it's just go figure out how do you make an extra $500,000. Even if you make 60 grand a year, 70, 80 grand a year, an extra $1,000, $1,500 a month can be meaningful, especially if it's all going to investing versus trying to.
Especially now when a lot of people aren't willing to do the work, right? And so, like you said, you can make so much money right now, I think. Joe, I don't know if this is going to go on forever, by the way. I mean, I hope that the economy is as strong as it is.
So do you mind talking about your personal portfolio a little bit? Like what not necessarily financial advice, but what you see as opportunities and what you kind of like?
Sure. So I own a lot of the QQQ, so the technology ETF. I own a lot of the SPY, and then I own a lot of Bitcoin. So yeah, I own a lot of Bitcoin. I mean, not as much as I probably should, but it's a lot. So,
and what is the reason behind Bitcoin and the QQQ?
Well, the Qs are getting beat up this week because the interest rates a little bit. But my thought is that the Qs are businesses that are almost like monopolies. They're almost like cartels. It's sad to say, but they are. And so to my point earlier about buying the spinning ball effect, I mean, Google is a spinning ball. It's going down the street and it's generating. I mean, what did you guys hear this? Google's revenue is like 30% growth rate. I mean, this is insane. Wow. After it's been growing as fast as it is, and now it's growing another 30%. And its EBITDA margins, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but their EBITDA margins are like 30, 35%. I mean, these things, I mean, they should be broken up, right? But they're like cartels. So I say to people, especially people not of means, I say, you know, and again, this is not investment advice, but I say, you know, go buy the cartels, go buy the monopolies. Like if that's the game we have to play, if that's how it's been rigged, buy the monopolies, buy those big companies. So I hold a lot of equity risk. I don't view it as a risk. I mean, it is a risk, but.
Do you hold bonds?
I don't.
Yeah. No. I feel gold. Like that's probably the biggest thing.
No gold. No.
I feel like that's probably the biggest thing.
Gold is a currency, you know, in my opinion. Bitcoin is a commodity, in my opinion. And I think it's becoming more of a currency, which is going to be really exciting, I think.
Yeah. The part to me is if we went and talked to folks that we know that are 60, 70 years old, everyone is 60, 40. Like that was the standard. When you go talk to younger people, you know, maybe 50s, maybe down into some 40s. They still have 60, 40, especially the financial advisors that still come out of that world, whatever. John's 25 years old. How many of your friends got 40% in their portfolio in bonds?
I don't know. We talked to Dylan the other day. He said he's over 100% allocated.
To what?
To Bitcoin. Oh, yeah.
Said he was taking out 0% interest rate credit cards last year to buy Bitcoin. It's like, jeez. Like, but I think that's the whole thing. It's like, I actually don't know if I have a friend who outside of traditional money management, like they're managing a fund where the mandate is to hold some bonds. I don't think I could tell you a single friend I have that owns bonds. I'm in my early 30s, right?
Certainly no one that manages their own personal portfolio.
So let me ask you a question to our earlier question earlier. Who's buying the mortgage bonds?
Oh, it's all the government.
Yeah.
Here's the craziest part of
what shrewd investors are buying mortgage bonds.
I wonder if we can figure out the average pension investment portfolio allocation.
But these are negative real rates, real negative interest rates, right? You have the interest rate less inflation.
Yeah. All right. So here is, all right. We have the average allocations for 2019, average asset allocations in the Fortune 100 pension portfolios. So Fortune 100 companies in their pensions, here's the average asset allocation. Now the average distribution by class, 50% of it is in debt. Right? So all sorts of various debt instruments. 3.3% in cash. Equity is 36%. Private equity is 2%. Real estate is 2%. Hedge funds 2%. Others 3%. So the largest holding in the Fortune 100 pension portfolios is debt. It's bonds. It's all sorts of kind of debt-like instruments. And so when you start to think about that, like what are they holding? They have to be losing money on it. I don't know of any credible debt that you can buy or bond that is producing more than a 5% return, right? So you're just losing on a real rate basis, and the pension funds have 50% of their assets there.
So on the topic of Bitcoin, and you know, I'm sure I'm going to ask you this later too off air, so I might as well ask you now. But so, you know, the unknown, right? Do you ever think about the unknown as it pertains to Bitcoin? You
like,
know,
like what is people the unknown? Say
Bitcoin risk, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I promise I'm not trying to spread FUD, but I'm just saying.
What are your questions? Let's just go right through all your Bitcoin questions.
I mean, I don't know. Do you ever think about the unknown?
Unknown in terms of unknown person who created it, unknown what's going to happen in the future?
Happen to it.
I mean, if you said to me right now, we'll do first the bear case for Bitcoin, then we'll talk about the bull case. The bear case for Bitcoin would be, It's a global store of value today. It's obvious that people have adopted this, grown into a $1 trillion asset. But unlike what the Bitcoin proponents believe, Bitcoin won't cross over into becoming a currency, and therefore that will drastically hamper kind of the addressable market. The most it could grow to is gold, which is basically a store of value, isn't really used for to go purchase things on a day-to-day basis. And therefore, yes, there may be more upside, but it's kind of a capped upside. Okay, that would be one critique of Bitcoin that people can make. The second one is eventually we're going to figure out who Satoshi is. And if we figure out who Satoshi is, that's going to be a bad person. And we're not going to want to know who it is. And like, there's going to be negative impact. Again, maybe, but unlikely. The next thing is nobody's using it for specific use cases like being able to actually do cross-border payments, all stuff. It's slow. It's expensive. It's got like all these like technical issues with it. And then there's an argument of the unknown of like the government's going to clamp down on it in the future.
Yeah, I don't think they can shut it down.
They're going to regulate it. They're going to tax it. They're going to shut it down. They're going to outlaw it. They're going to do all this type of stuff. If you take every single one of those things, none of them are a 0% chance. But what is the 2% on each of those? Right? Each thing has 1-2% chance. And so, okay,
and
sure.
I'm not even talking about those. I'm just, you know, maybe it's totally uneducated. It's just... One thing that gives me a little bit of trepidation is I trust Elon Musk a lot.
Uh-huh.
And you look at his conviction around Bitcoin versus Dorsey, and it makes you think, you know, well, what are his thoughts on? I mean, I know he owns a lot though, right?
From what I understand, it's a material part of his net worth personally. Yeah. Yeah. On top of SpaceX.
I think
the best argument somebody could make, and what I think is the biggest risk to Bitcoin, it really pisses the critics off because it has nothing to do with anything external. There's still a development process. There is still a upgrade process to Bitcoin, and it's incredibly methodical. It's incredibly intentional. It's slow on purpose, lots of kind of filters and security checks, et cetera. But technically, there could be a bug in the code that's introduced.
Yeah, and so I guess
it's like shooting yourself in the foot, right? Yeah,
could that happen? Or I mean, anything.
I mean, and the electricity in the world could shut off because a meteor hit the Earth.
But
right?
If you think about it, the governments can't shut it down. Can't have nuclear war shut it down, right? I mean, you have to have nuclear bombs all across the world, right? I mean,
that's and crazy. Even then, you probably still wouldn't shut down. There's still going to be one computer somewhere that is running that software.
It's kind of like Elon last night. Somebody was saying like, "Oh, should the government shut it down?" Or I don't know. And he's like, "They can't," or something. Or what did he say last night?
We were talking about it. He basically said that they can't kill Bitcoin.
Yeah,
right.
The piece that I think most people forget about all of this is when you have an asset that isn't going to get shut down, the game theory takes over. So let's say that there's four of us in a room. You say, I'm not going to buy any, and neither is anybody else. So you're in the camp of nobody adopts it. John is in the camp of saying, I'm not going to adopt it, but somebody else is. Joe's in the camp of I'm going to adopt it and nobody else is. And I'm in the camp of I'm going to buy and so is everybody else, right? If you kind of think of a 4x2 grid as like a game theory, if nobody adopts it like you, nothing changes in the world. If you're in John's seat, you don't adopt it and everyone else adopts it, you're last, right, to adopt it. That ends up being a really bad situation, both from a security standpoint and also a financial standpoint. If you're in Joe's position, which is he adopts it and nobody else adopts it, then you end up being way ahead of everybody else, but it almost doesn't matter because the value of the market is determined by, is there demand for an asset, right? That's true of every asset since the beginning of time. So actually, everyone is financially incentivized to do what? To participate, but it's also driven by everyone else participating, and that's where you get value in an asset. So from a game theory standpoint, you get hurt by not participating, and you don't necessarily get hurt if you participate and others don't. But the trend is everyone's participating, right? So it's like that was the kind of game theory in 2009, 2010. Now, there's no question, are other people going to do this? So the game theory takes over and it's like, you should participate. And again, it could be 0.1% of your entire net worth, right? It doesn't mean you got to go do a lot or whatever, but the game theory is really strong here.
Yeah, and... you know, to be clear, I own a lot, like, because it because in dollars, it makes me think like, wow, I own a lot of Bitcoin. Like I should really make sure I know what the hell's going on with this thing. And I think I've done the due diligence, but I own a little over 10%, which is not a lot in terms of when you, I mean, you own like what, 95% of your net worth in the damn thing.
Yeah.
I mean, so when I asked the question about the unknown and you know, your mind could go a zillion different directions. It just, how do you get the confidence to go from 10% to 95%.
Your 10% is in the new digital financial system.
Yep.
Your 90% in the legacy financial system.
Couldn't they say that about Ethereum though?
It could be what you buy whatever asset you want, right? And guess what? The market's going to determine who wins and loses. I'm most comfortable with and I have the most confidence in Bitcoin. Because here's the other thing that I think happens in the crypto world that people misunderstand is I think of the risk spectrum in, let's call it the crypto industry. On the far left, you have the least risky asset, Bitcoin. It is kind of the blue chip, largest, most decentralized, longest track record, et cetera.
1,000%.
In crypto, least risky, most conservative asset. On the other end of the spectrum, you have crazy things that people are coming up with, all kinds of tokens and schemes and innovations and experiments and whatever that you can go buy for a penny, right? So you have on one end, super conservative. On the other end, you have super risky. When you look at the crypto industry, what most people are doing is they come into the industry and the people who end up going way out on the risk curve, they literally say, oh yeah, of course Bitcoin's gonna work, but I want better returns than Bitcoin. They're chasing something that is higher or better performing than Bitcoin alone. And so what I think about is the reason why Bitcoin is so attractive is I actually don't need to have the best returning asset. I don't need to be greedy. I want the thing that has a great economic return, but also I know it's gonna be around in 50 years.
So let me ask you, do you have anxiety about not putting the rest of your 5% in Bitcoin?
No, because a lot of that ends up being, and when I use percentages, usually liquid net worth, I've got cash, and then I still make some private investments mm-hmm. as well. So in some crazy way, like if I invest in a company that then is using the Lightning Network, like it's not Bitcoin exposure, but you know,
yeah, it's pretty close.
It's definitely related. The other piece of it,
by the way, tell me if we're going off topic too.
No,
by the way,
this is perfect. Okay. I'll talk about Bitcoin all day long. Yeah. So will they?
Well, I think these are a lot of questions a lot of people have. And you're like the Bitcoin guy. I mean, if you want to know about housing, I'll tell you about it all day long.
You compare what I just talked about in the crypto world of like conservative on one end, super risky on the other end of the crypto industry. If you look at the regular financial world, like the legacy financial world, Bitcoin is the most risky asset you could buy, right? And then like maybe bonds or cash or something is on like the other end. And so the beauty of sitting in like that Bitcoin seat is that all of the crypto guys and girls who are like way out on the risk curve, they're like, this is like the most, like, what are you doing, right? Like, that's not going to drive you great returns.
Yeah, they call you a boomer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the legacy finance world, like, I go talk to, you know, big hedge funds, right? They're like, what are you doing? Like, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah.
That's actually probably where you want to be.
I agree.
Right? Yeah. Like, I know there's way crazier things that you could do in the world, but I also know that there's way safer things you could do in the world. So, like,
but 95% is very respectable. You don't say that often, do you? I mean, I hear you say it once in a while.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a crazy number until you just say, no, I just denominate my life and my portfolio in Bitcoin. So it's no different than dollars, right? If you have 100%, most people, right, in dollar-denominated bonds or dollar-denominated assets, you essentially have 100% exposure to what I think of as the legacy financial world. And so if you ask me right now, gun to my head, which financial world has the most room to grow moving forward? Well, the legacy world is like, we've had it for, you know, 100 plus years, right? Like it's been here. There's just not that much future growth to it versus we get this crazy stuff. And it's why like the stock market, everyone's freaking out over 2% drop, right? I mean, literally right now, Bitcoin could drop 5% and no one would even care. It's just like, yeah, of course it goes up and down, you know, 3, 5, 10% a day.
Are you surprised it's not higher now?
I don't know if I'm necessarily surprised it's not higher. Hindsight bias is real strong because you kind of understand why it's not higher. But I would be very surprised if it doesn't go much higher through the end of this year. Like if we didn't at least get a new all-time high, something happened that I either didn't understand, didn't foresee, or just missed, right? All-time high is only 20K away. It's like a 50% move from here, which, again, sounds crazy in legacy terms in Bitcoin crypto world. Like, you know, that's like could happen in a week. And then on top of that, it's like once it breaks through the all-time high, like where does it go? I mean, we've had how many people come on and you hear everything from 80 to somebody recently said 400,000 this year. Like,
yeah.
And they all have a good explanation. And you're like, yeah, all 80 to 400,000 is all possible, right?
That's funny.
So we'll see. How do you think about buying stocks versus like more Bitcoin or anything that's like more like alternative investor private markets?
Well, I've been thinking about upping my percent of Bitcoin. So I've recently gone over that 10% amount and it's growing because it's getting to be bigger, you know, but...
Do you rebalance? That's another thing that I see a lot of institutions love to rebalance, but in some weird way, you're basically taking your best performers and you're cutting your exposure versus just make the investments and then just let them turn into whatever they
do. Yeah, not really. I mean, in the early days, I was selling a little bit of Bitcoin, but that was because it just went up so quick that you're just like, what the, you know, what is going on here, you know? And I always get worried about the psychological phenomena of like confirmation bias. And it's like, okay, like, yeah, I think it's going up because I know why it's going up, but do I really know why it's going up? And it keeps just going, you know? So no, I don't really
care. Imagine being one of these guys that has $1 billion of it or, you know, $5 billion of it. And it keeps going up, right?
Yeah. Since you must think you're a genius.
It gets pretty crazy, right? I mean, Joe and John is the best story. I think we've told on this on the show before is Joe called me one day and John had bought Bitcoin, whenever it was. And he goes, yo, you got to talk to John. And I was like, why? And he's like, John said he ain't going to make it to 20K. It was at like 11. And I was like, what do you mean? And he goes, yeah, he said, dude, this thing goes to 20, I'm selling.
And now what percent of your guys' money do you have in it?
Very similar amount.
95?
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, I'm probably in the, I got to do some calculations, but I'm probably in like the 90s.
I hope I don't buy more today.
But here's what you have to remember is it's also different when you're younger, when like.
Yeah, but I'm 33, right? And I see it and I see Bitcoin as play, you know, as plain as day, right?
Yeah.
I don't understand people who don't see it, but.
John.
I think that's the light bulb, right? Is like once you realize that and you think of it in the context of like it's inevitable, right? To some degree, you start aggressively figuring out how you can acquire more, right? And knowing that it's constrained supply, all you're looking at is the demand becomes a no-brainer.
You want to hear a story I never told anybody before?
I like the philanthropy aspect.
In 2018, I took 50% of basically my net worth, my portfolio, whatever you want to say, and I put it in Bitcoin. And it happened to be near the bottom of the bear market in 2018. In December of, I think the bottom was like December 14th or whatever. And I remember walking around because Bitcoin had been, it had gone from 20 to 6,500 and there's like this like puke down. I remember walking around New York City and just like thinking to myself, like you're either insane or like you know something that they all don't see or know or whatever. And I'd been paying attention to it for, you know, a number of years, whatever, at that point, maybe 2-3 years, whatever it was. And I remember saying to myself, this is likely what the housing short trade, the dot-com bust, like all these different things is, it's a combination not only of the information that you have been able to spend time and learn and do all that, but also the way that you evaluate it, the way that you analyze and understand, or at least think you understand how it's gonna play out or whatever. And at some point you just gotta say to yourself, like you just trust yourself, right? At least for me. And so I was just like, all right, screw it. And I knew that the reason why I did 50 was because I was willing to lose that, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, look, at that point I was, you know, I don't know.
So would you be willing 30. To lose the 95% that you have now?
Yeah, which is why I'm comfortable doing that, right? But it's because I've got high earning potential. I'm still young. Like I could recover. If I was 45 or 50, I wouldn't do it. It's all about like, I think a lot about, there's a book, Richer, Wiser, Happier. I think it's the name of it by William Green. And he basically goes out and he interviews like the top 25 investors he can find. And so he has this guy, Pat Bry, who's like famous for just emulating Warren Buffett. He has Nick Sleep. He's got a bunch of these guys that he goes in and he talks to. And he's basically like, what are you doing? He even interviews Charlie Munger for the book or whatever. And there's two key things that I learned in that book that surprised me. One, majority of the best investors in the world, high concentration in their portfolio. It's like Charlie Munger only owns three stocks.
Yeah.
Right? It's like Berkshire Hathaway, Costco, and I forget what the third one is. And you're like, wait, what? Like, now Berkshire owns a bunch of different, you know, businesses, whatever, but like he only owns three stocks, I think.
So what do you think the chances are, though, if you're investing in those three companies and having enough knowledge to beat the S&P?
I think that's kind of like table stakes at this point, right? Is if you go back to, somebody was telling me this recently, so bear with me if the stats aren't exactly right. But if you go back and you look at all the ICOs from 2017, right? And you look at them today, the scams, the like all the things that literally, and I was one of the biggest people saying like, hey, I'm not investing in any of this. This is all nonsense to me. It's up like 300% today. Mm. And so you're like, literally things that I personally believe have no value, right?
Yeah.
That like a lot of people were pointing at being like, this is literally a scam. It's still up a ton. And the reason why that ends up happening is it's not because it's valuable. It's because you're betting on an industry that ends up growing so significantly. And so you're betting on something that's small and ends up growing up. And so when you think of it that way, like why would you end up actually investing in the legacy market? Like you could be, what was the hamster that's beating the S&P by
Mr. Gox?
Did you hear about this?
Yeah, Mr. Gox.
Right? Mr. Gox. He's like
Gox
he's,
Capital.
Yeah. He's running around. He's got a hamster and he's running around. He's beating the S&P. Why? He's literally doing it with assets that are going up significantly more than the S&P.
Yeah,
you can feel right there with the Bitcoin 100K hat.
Now we'll have business. To go buy more Bitcoin.
Now we're in business.
No, but seriously, the reason that I take it so seriously is not just because of my own family and you know, trying to provide for my family with money. But if I can figure out how to compound, to our point earlier, returns over a period of time, you know, my capital, I look at it as helping fuel a lot of this transaction volume that's going across Twitter for the poverty angle. So it's a very helpful discussion.
I completely agree. Before we move to wrap up here, I have one question. And then if we get to 5K likes, Joe's giving away $1,000. Don't think
we didn't hit it. We didn't hit 5K yet.
All right, Bill,
we're close.
What do you think Bitcoin's price goes to this year in 2021?
Well, I'll give you that, but I think that it's going to be $1 million a coin.
And okay,
not this year necessarily. Maybe not this cycle, but I think pretty soon it will be. I think that. If we get another momentum in the market, it's just my opinion. And, you know, these things, they trade with momentum, you know, even like MSTR stock, it trades with momentum. If we get an upward momentum and let's say that there's continues to be this high inflation print, you know, there's no ceiling to where it could go, but I would say, you know, 75, I think it'll at least be at 75.
So new all-time high this year.
Yeah.
And then you think that at some point in the next couple of years, $1 million.
Yeah, I think probably mid next year, I think that it will get harder. Just the growth in the economy, I think, will be harder on stuff. And I do think Bitcoin, and we may disagree on this, I do think Bitcoin, at least from what I've seen, tends to trade like a commodity from what I've seen. And I've been a little disappointed with it the last couple of weeks at how much it traded even with the market. But I guess it's probably nothing compared to what it used to be, right?
It happens. It tends to be a non-correlated asset, but there are periods where it gets high correlation. And a lot of it's the macro stuff where people just start saying, hey, this is a risk asset or whatever. And also it used to be a much different audience that held Bitcoin. As you get into now more financially savvy folks with it, then you're going to have them trade it like it's another stock or another commodity in their portfolio versus historically those people who they didn't care about the financials.
And again, this is out of my circle of competency, so I don't really know it, but you know, you asked, so that's what I think.
Where can we send people to find out more Twitter philanthropy?
Teamgiving.com. Teamgiving.com. That's the big philanthropy, or that's the big 501c3 that we've set up where people with legitimate needs can go and it will be vetted by an experienced team. So we haven't figured out the decentralized way yet, but just given the demand, we didn't want to just rely on GoFundMe. So it's been a great thing working with the team at Team Giving. And you know, just if you see somebody and your heart tells you to donate, great. If not, it's all good.